Most of them are women and children, emaciated and sick. Their warriors' morale is low. They don't have single leadership. They're about to starve. Many of them are seriously ill. I'm afraid we might see the first funeral pyres in their camp already this morning.
Laosh must have noticed me frowning, because he added,
Olgid, I know you wanted us to allow them into the city. Still, we can't afford it. Yes, they are Chaldeans like ourselves. True, we have a provisional truce in place. Still, they're more numerous. Unlike you, we know their leaders and what they're capable of. We can't risk it.
He's right, Droy agreed. We've done a lot for them as it is. We've shared our food supplies with them, even though there won't be enough for us now. Our healers are doing what they can. And most importantly, you've let them enter under the protection of the magic sphere. Trust me, that's more than enough.
To spend a night in a perfectly safe place without having to worry about a surprise attack in the night is worth a lot,
Krim added.
But even despite everything Laosh has just said, I don't think they're going to stay with us,
Orman summed up.
I agree.
Shorv nodded, without looking up from his sewing.
Bad War is too proud. I don't think he's going to go hat in hand to a red owl. Besides, they already know about the Horde's arrival. If they chose not to fight when all of their warriors were still alive, what makes you think they'll do it now?
That was a killer argument. We had nothing to say to that. Droy was about to object when his son hurried into the tent.
Father, you're wanted on the wall.
Droy rose.
What now?
The boy messenger said that the northern wolves were back.
The morning seeped a dull sunlight by way of greeting the earth. It might actually snow later. We had to hurry. Despite the early hour, works were already in full swing in the outer moat, which encircled the fortress like a giant snake trail. The open areas outside the wall had been cleared of snow. Fires burned all along the perimeter, warming the ground and thawing out the ancient ruins. Dozens of Chaldeans were bustling about in the moat, scooping out the molten slush and hammering in sharp stakes of different sizes. They'd been putting in a united effort, relieving each other day and night. No one was shirking. This was a matter of survival. The newcomers watched them closely, exchanging comments in low voices, and casting glances at the wall and the glaive-throwers mounted upon it. Oh well, let them look. That might give their thoughts a push in the right direction. Even in their work clothes, the red owls looked dramatically more civilized now, and the wall they were building kept growing in leaps and bounds. The Chaldeans had never made anything as good as this wall. Still, at the moment, we had more important things to think of than worrying about the newcomer's state of mind. Droy's son had been right. We had the northern wolves on our doorstep. Not a small recon group. This time we were looking at their entire clan. The proud step riders trudged in silence, looking pretty worse for wear. There wasn't a single warrior among them. Holy Mamma Mia, how many of them were there? My warriors lined up along the perimeter of the magic sphere's radius. What kind of Groundhog Day was this? We'd been standing here only a few hours ago, just like we were now, greeting Bad War and his group. But in this case, we had no reason to be too strict. We had a treaty with the wolves, after all. They could come and go as they pleased. The red owls crowded by the wall, greeting the tired wolves with tears in their eyes. About 200 armed men rode in the rear. This must have been what was left of Amay's little army. Actually, I couldn't see him anywhere. Pike appeared to be in command. Exhausted and wounded, his left arm bandaged, he was the last to cross the magic protection border. His horse snorted as it stopped a few paces away from us. Pike dismounted unhurriedly and with dignity.
"Greetings, O Keeper," he croaked.
"Greetings, valiant warrior," I replied, studying him closely. He had an impressive black eye. His clothes were covered in blood, others as well as his own. Oh, he'd had it rough. "Brave warrior, I can't see your leader," I said. Still standing tall, Pike heaved a sigh.
"My leader and 200 of our best warriors have met their end fighting the Noctians."
The devs had to be kidding. I lost another shaman.
"I remembered our treaty," he continued, "which is why I brought the survivors here."
"You did the right thing, O Pike of many hands." I motioned them to enter. "My owls and I, we hold our treaty sacred."
Chapter 17.
"I think I've found something."
A grinning Pretus slapped the Brock's ample leg. He had asked to see me as soon as our round table with all the clan leaders had finished. Predictably, it had ended in nothing. You couldn't imagine a more fruitless pastime. It reminded me of a well-known Russian fable telling the story of the swan, the pike, and the crab who tried to pull a heavy cartload. Naturally, it didn't work, because each of them tried to pull it each in their own direction. I hadn't taken part in the discussion. What was the point? The Chaldean leaders didn't recognize my authority. I didn't have enough reputation with them. Having said that, my personal relationship with Bad War had improved from suspicious to neutral. Ditto for the other two, Gucker and Levina. I had a bad feeling about the four of them. First Pike, and now those three. They actually had a lot in common. All four were celebrated warriors whose names commanded respect from every Chaldean. I just hoped I wasn't going to get into trouble. Which wasn't so improbable, knowing me. A hand lay on my shoulder.
"Are you listening?"
"Huh? Sorry?" Pretus squinted at me. A sarcastic grin played on his lips.
"Are you with me?"
"I'm sorry," I said, rubbing my eyes. "All these council meetings are exhausting." Pretus and I had grown quite close over the last few days. Having to assemble a bunch of Ennin machines does that to you.
"They don't want to become owls, do they?"
He grinned his understanding. The glasses of his pince-nez glinted.
"Not the first time."
I remembered the black axes. They used to scream and dig their heels in, too. You could say that.
Olgod, you know what? Out of all of us, I was the one who was most against joining the Red Owls.
So, what do you think now?
Now I think joining you was the best thing I ever did.
Really? What made you change your mind?
You did. Our other leaders used to send us to a sure death, deceiving us with high goals and made-up prophecies. Their inflated egos and their fear of losing power prevented us from joining together in order to confront the enemy. Their cowardice forced us to leave our homes. When our shaman died, followed by some of the stronger warriors who could have claimed leadership, we felt free for the first time. Can you imagine? Nothing like that had ever happened to us before. For the first time in its history, the Council of Elders could actually decide something. Before, they only used to go through the motions. And this time, the fates of the clan depended on our decision.
Despite Predis's praise, I still had my doubts. What if I was just as stupid as their previous leaders? What if it didn't work? What if I had brought them to a sure death? In the meantime, Predis continued.
Freedom intoxicated us. We were our own masters. And you know the important thing? Yes, we became Red Owls, but that was our own choice. Can I give you some advice?
Good advice is always welcome.
Give them some space. Let them enjoy their freedom. Let them experience the full extent of it. Once the euphoria wears off, it'll leave behind the great responsibility for one's clanmates' lives. Then they'll need someone who knows what to do without losing their precious freedom.
You think I can do it?
Well,
Pretus smiled.
We're still alive, aren't we? And I don't think our shamans had anything to do with it.
I don't think so either. We laughed. Finally, Pretus asked,
So, fancy doing a bit of work?
Sure, I replied. What's all this about?
I've studied all the machines,
Pretus explained readily,
and I noticed a very interesting thing. All the brocks and glaive throwers have indentations in the same place, same size. What's interesting is that these indentations spread energy canals through the whole length of the machines.
Strange, I said. What do you make of it?
I had a talk with a few fellow engineers, and we think that this indentation is in fact a plug to plug a power block in, which means that the machines are self-contained. As long as we supply them with power blocks, they can work non-stop. Naturally, we went directly to the warehouse. We looked everywhere, but we didn't find anything which even remotely looked like them.
Show me, I said, curious. Pretus motioned me to approach, then pointed at a small indentation.
This one.
You're right, I said. Did you say all the machines have them?
Yes,
Pretus replied.
The Brocks have them on their second right leg. The glaive throwers just next to the trigger.
It's hexagonal, I commented. Pretus nodded.
That's right. I can bet all you want they're meant for plugging in accumulator crystals.
Which can't be big. Incredible. Can you imagine that a tiny piece of crystal can power something this huge? I was about to touch the indentation to see how deep it was when a new system message appeared before my eyes. Would you like to plug in the charm of a rock? Yes? No? Startled, I jerked my hand away, then reread the message. The charm of a rock. The charm of a rock. The name rang a few bells. Where could I have heard about it? Wait a sec. I had a head like a sieve, really. By assembling the machines, I'd leveled up my other profession really well. I'd had those old blueprints in my bag ever since I'd built the replicator, albeit dimmed and inactive. Now that I'd assembled the Brocks, they'd finally become available, so I'd studied them just in case, then happily forgotten all about it. No wonder. Too many things had been happening just lately.
Can you feel anything?
Pretus's voice asked, just above my ear. Oh, I'd forgotten all about him. I think so, I said, theatrically closing my eyelids. I need to concentrate.
I got it. I'll be silent as a grave.
Excellent. I hurried to press the blueprint studied tab. What did we have here?
Yes,
the unworked charm of a rock. I could do that. I had 70 of the wretched things in my bag. And I used to think those were useless trash items. What other blueprints did I have? Name, a blueprint of the frame of the charm of a rock. Requirements, a bundle of steel wire. 1. Pretus, I said, without opening my eyes, I might need some steel wire. A few bundles will do. Ask the blacksmiths. They should have loads there. They use it all the time to make chainmail.
Got it,
Pretus replied. The sound of his footsteps faded quickly. Good. What next? Name, a blueprint of the charm of a rock. Requirements, a frame of the charm of a rock. 1. An unworked charm of a rock. 1. 5,000 points energy. I made a quick estimation. That was enough for 20 rounds from the Brock and 5 glaive clips. My heart pounded like mad. That meant that I wouldn't be tied to the machines anymore. When I opened my eyes, Pretus was scurrying toward me with Zachary in tow.
Here, take your pick.
He offered me several bundles of steel wire in different sizes. I began trying them, but the system rejected each and every one of them. I very nearly cussed. There I was, one step away from an energy breakthrough, had it not been for a miserable piece of wire. Damn those blueprints! I might need to leave the city and go back to the continent.
This is all chainmail wire,
Zachary said, who until now had been watching my manipulations in silence.
Try this one. It's thinner, but just as strong. It's jewelry wire I use to make chains with.
I took it from him. Yes, it worked. The system was happy with our offering. Congratulations. You've just built a frame of the charm of a rock. I reached into my backpack for the fragment of blue ice. Would you like to build a charm of a rock? Warning. Building a charm of a rock will deprive you of 5,000 points pure energy. Would you like to continue? Accept, decline. The moment I pressed accept, my hands began living a life of their own. This time I wasn't even scared. The experience was familiar. My right hand picked up the frame, my left one the unworked charm. In one smooth motion, I joined the two parts.
A flash followed, depleting me of 5,000 points energy. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched Pretus's and Zachary's open-mouthed faces. Congratulations! You've built a charm of a rock.
All done.
Is this what I think it is?
Pretus managed. I think so, my learned friend, I replied, walking over to the Brock. All we have to do now is test it. Would you like to connect the charm of a rock to the Brock? Yes? No. The moment of truth. I pressed yes, then plugged my creation in. It fit the indentation like a glove. Congratulations! The Brock's power charge has grown 5,000 points. Warning! The depletion of the power charge will destroy the charm. A small handle appeared next to the plug. Now, Pretus and his assistants could control the Brock without me. Excellent! The only problem was, the charms had turned out to be disposable, and I only had 69 fragments of blue ice left. No idea where I could get any more. Suddenly, an idea struck me. And what if... If you refuse to work now, I'll scrap you. I promise I will, I murmured, producing the replicator.
You sure you're an engineer?
Pretus laughed, watching me. I smiled to him. Good question. The moment I placed the charm into the replicator's tray, the system generously offered a new message. Would you like to start the replication process? Finally, this weird contraption, which resembled a school microscope, was good for something. It had been worth lugging it around the no man's lands after all. Yes, I would. I would very much like to start this wretched process. Upon receiving my consent, the strange device came to life. Its tiny cogwheels, springs, and little coils started moving. The charm lying in the tray dematerialized. What was that now? What if everything went wrong? What if I'd misunderstood the meaning of replication? What if the game developers had their own ideas of what it was supposed to signify? 20 seconds seemed like 20 hours. Still, the little machine hadn't let me down. Congratulations! The replication process successfully completed. Replication results. The charm of a rock. 3. Time until next replication, 23 hours, 59 minutes, 59 seconds.
Chapter 18.
The previous night, I'd warned Droy I was going to go on a recon flight. I'd already assembled all the Ennin machines. Camp life was more or less under control. I could safely entrust the whole caboodle to him. We had too many enemies, the Noctian horde, as well as the players of both dark and light, and we needed to know where they were exactly. I was the only one up to the task. Without the intel, we were blind. There was another reason, though, and I wasn't in a hurry to divulge it to anyone. And that was the question I'd asked myself 1,000 times before. If I failed to discover the Twilight Obelisk, then what? What was to happen then? And the more I tried to analyze the situation, the grimmer it seemed to me. This Ennin city was in fact a trap, a choice morsel whose job it was to attract all the vultures in the area. Naturally, I still hoped that this wretched obelisk would one day declare itself, but in the meantime, our magic protection was dwindling, and nothing was happening. Honestly, I felt worried. on the brink of panic even. In such cases, I always need a backup option. Two would be even better. In other words, I was desperate for Plan B. So, while the sphere was still active, I decided to spend some time working on it. I decided to start with the Silver Mountain Valley, which was in the south, about 2 weeks' hike from Ennin City, and a month away from the Players' territories. That was the Chaldeans' original home, which they'd been forced to surrender to the Horde. According to them, it used to be a great place to live. Lots of fields and lakes, mountains and meadows. It only snowed there in wintertime. So, naturally, I had a question. If the Noctian Horde was already on its way here, what was going on at Silver Mountain? So, I decided to check it out. The thick, viscous fog covered the ground like an enormous, endless quilt. I couldn't see anything below in the white haze, which promised an approaching snowstorm. I had to land. A rocky ridge nearby looked just the thing. Obeying my mental command, Boris began to descend. The rocks were unbelievable. I stared, transfixed, at their bizarre shapes carved by Mother Nature, thwarted by the realization of my own insignificance in the face of these behemoths. At moments like these, I didn't want to remember that they were only stage props created by programmers and game designers. Their powerful tops seemed to be piercing the sky. The thick snow clouds got caught on their massive primeval bodies. Finding a natural wonder like this here had come as a complete surprise. I looked around me. The barren surface was covered in dry tufts of some scrub sprouting out of every crack and fissure. I couldn't see a single creature sheltering within their entwined branches, not a bird's nest nor a single rodent. The place looked dead. We were still too high. The fog prevented me from seeing anything below. A touch of frosty breeze brushed my face, growing stronger with every minute. It swept the fog away, replacing it with a fresh, crisp transparency. Soon, I was looking at a truly fascinating picture. A boundless valley lay below, studded with clusters of cliffs. The wind had dispersed the last of the fog, revealing the panorama in all its majestic serenity. But that wasn't what had made my heart miss a beat. A countless herd of some animals was grazing below, at what looked like a deceitfully close distance. Wait a sec. Aren't they buffaloes? So many? I almost choked with the discovery. I leapt into the saddle and told Boris to descend. A large herd like that was bound to attract unwanted attention. I was almost sure some large predators were already lurking nearby. The ground below was a filthy mess of slush mixed with animal excrement, trampled in by thousands of hooves. Was it my imagination, or the further into no man's lands I advanced, the more lifelike everything had become around me? Those were buffaloes, all right. They were slightly bigger than those bred by the Chaldeans, tall, with long, powerful legs and broad hooves. Their long hair was gray, spotted with black. They had small ears and long horns that pointed forward, crowning their large heads. Without straying too far from their enormous herd, buffaloes grazed calmly, scooping the mud with their hooves in order to get to the blue moss covering the frozen ground. The air hung heavy with the smell of dung. The herd had ignored our arrival entirely. Either the wind was blowing toward us, or they were too short-sighted. Or, most likely, they simply didn't consider my flying beast to be a threat. The boundless valley stretched to the horizon. There was enough blue moss here to feed dozens of herds like this one. The buffaloes flowed across the valley unhurriedly, like a gray river, feeding, bellowing, defecating, leaving the ground in their wake plowed as if by 1,000 tractors. We continued our flight along a rocky ridge that stretched the entire length of the valley. I noticed several streams babbling happily amid the cliffs. A few minutes later, I came across a family of wild pigs. I decided to stop for a while to watch them from above. We landed on a cliff ledge. Immediately, Boris stretched out on the rocks, lounging happily. I, too, was enjoying the peaceful break, watching a totally cute family of wild pigs. Their daddy, the boar, was enormous, the size of an adult rhino. His powerful yellow tusks protruded far from under his lower lip, making him look a bit like a forklift. He used them to peruse through the frozen ground with ease, leaving deep furrows in his wake. He was a mountain of muscle, propped on fat, stubby legs. A few smaller males were feeding nearby, snorting contentedly as they dug through the earth. The tuskless females followed closely behind, with their snouts pressed to the ground, vacuuming up any remaining food. Baby pigs frolicked around, squeaking happily, and adding an extra note of cuteness to their family idol. I leaned against Boris's soft belly, admiring the scene. I'd always loved animals, and enjoyed watching them. And now, with every hour that I spent in this dangerous and formidable land, I realized I was becoming one with its forest, growing into these cliffs and this valley. I definitely liked it here. And not just because of the breathtaking views. I was yet to see a mob below level 50. The daddy boar was level 600 plus. A huge territory, densely populated with high-level mobs, was an excellent addition to my plan B. The forest beyond the cliff ridge looked perfectly normal. I even noticed some conifers, their evergreen needles standing out bright amid the bare trees still awakening from their hibernation. Spring was in the air. After the lifeless and silent snow dunes, the valley felt like some kind of wildlife metropolis. A flock of birds arrived and began dashing around on their own errands, chirruping and trilling in a multitude of calls. We resumed our flight and banked to the right, following the buffalo herd. We seemed to be heading in the same direction. Such a huge mass of potential prey was bound to attract predators. Speak of the devil. I could clearly see a large pack of some black animals exit the forest. Big cats, by the looks of it. Their young, restless, and quarrelsome followed the pride. A group of a dozen adult felines led the pride. They slid across the valley like unstoppable black torpedoes,
stealing up on the unsuspecting herd in a predatory semicircle. The sight was breathtaking. The cat's giant leader broke into a run, leaping toward the buffaloes, who seemed to be already aware of the danger. The cat's blood-curdling growl sent shivers down my spine. The buffaloes nearest to it seemed to have frozen in panic. Admittedly, I couldn't move either. Finally, the herd heaved and flowed away, trying to escape their pursuers. Still, they'd wasted too much time. The leading cat, as fast as an arrow, rammed the edge of the herd and clawed its way into the very thick of the terrified animals. Drunk on blood and their fear, it towered over their gray bodies. The other cats followed, trampling the poor buffaloes and ripping them apart. Seeing the adults feasting on their prey, the cubs darted for a long-overdue meal, too, rolling into the mutilated herd like a ball of yelping, fighting fluff. "I think we've seen enough," I grumbled to Boris. "Let's go." Midday enveloped the valley and the cliffs in its warm, sunny veil. Unable to resist the all-pervasive sun rays, the snow had melted into hundreds of little streams, trickling away from their home to new, unknown horizons. The winter-tired cliffs offered their frozen flanks to the sun. Spring was traveling across the valley, her every fleeting green step reviving the frigid, unyielding soil from its anabiosis. The more I saw, the more I liked this location. At least it was much warmer here. The further we flew, the nicer the temperature got. We'd parted ways with the giant buffalo herd, which continued its flow deep into the valley while we were still skirting it, following the mountain ridge. The cliffs seemed to be changing, too. Overgrown with low shrubs and new grass, they now resembled fluffy green giants. Bird flocks clamored amid the greenery, busy with their own agendas. We landed on a mountaintop. I jumped down from the saddle and stretched my legs, then reached into my backpack for my fur coat. With my back to the valley, I unfolded it while casting an absent-minded eye over the forest to the other side of the ridge. I froze in disbelief. A thin streak of smoke rose, swirling to the sky from the thick of the forest, quite close to where we now stood. I blinked and rubbed my eyes, then looked again. The weak gray trail hadn't disappeared anywhere. It reached bolt upright to the sky and dissipated high overhead. What was that now? Players? Other Chaldeans? Or other NPCs? I checked my clothes and weapons and leapt back into the saddle. Boris made off toward the smoke. As we flew, I gave it some thought. It probably wouldn't be a good idea to expose ourselves to any Tom, Dick, or Harry. The fact that they didn't even try to conceal the smoke could only mean one of two things. They were either clueless beginners, or they had no one to hide from. You had to be really careful in this world of hungry, toothy, angry mobs who considered you to be their rightful meal. What kind of creature could it be that could control fire, but wasn't afraid of prowling cats or Noctian hordes? How sure was I they would be happy to see me? Lots of questions, and the only way to answer them was by going on a recon mission. Right, Sir Olgird. Off you go. The smoke trail brought me to a small farm, surrounded by a flimsy, low stockade. Parts of it had collapsed, revealing the still smoldering skeleton of what must have once been a log hut. The stockade appeared very old. The logs it was built from were dark and dried with age, crudely sharpened and spotted with patches of green moss. This looked like an illustration to a Grimm's tale, the stockade baring its rickety teeth against a backdrop of gnarly gray wood. Having made a few circles over the farm and found no signs of life, I decided to drop down. Having landed by the forest edge, I looked around me, listening out for any sounds. I noticed some weird paw prints on the ground, leading toward the stockade. At first, they were large, with sharp claws. After a few feet, they seemed to have transformed, becoming smaller and smaller, until they reached the stockade, where they turned into the prints of a small human. I got the impression that something huge and very carnivorous, judging by the size of its claws, had walked out of the woods very recently and headed for the farm grounds. And this something had turned into a human in the process, the size of a 10-year-old child. Then again, I could be wrong. I'm not a Boy Scout, am I? I followed the footprints until they brought me to a hole in the stockade. Here, the thick black logs clumsily driven into the loose ground had listed, as if having been hit by something very big and very heavy. Whoever had lived on the farm had paid a high price for their recklessness. They should have fixed the stockade when they'd had the chance. Apparently, whoever had left the weird footprints in the snow didn't forgive this kind of oversight. I peeked through the gap. The entire farm was about an acre. All of its outbuildings were burnt. Everything was covered in brown spots of caked blood. The trampled snow sported all kinds of footprints, including the clawed ones. Oh, I must have been right then. This looked like one of the remote Chaldean settlements. Maybe a family which had split away from their clan. Judging by the miserable quality of the fence and the buildings, they'd been in a bad way. Or had they relaxed without the threat of an external enemy? God knows. In any case, this farm was dead. Time for us to go.
Chapter 19.
Less than 2 hours later, Boris brought us to an endless expanse of water. It was marked on the map as the White Sea. Between the heavy swell, the freezing wind, and the dark clouds, I wouldn't call its shores particularly welcoming. Despite the obnoxious weather, Boris soared effortlessly under the clouds on his powerful wings. He even looked pleased, enjoying this bit of extreme flying. I was about to tell him to head back inland when I noticed a few dark, oblong spots on the shore. From afar, they resembled the dead bodies of either beached seals or very large birds. That wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't for the way they were positioned. The bodies were lined up neatly, as if by a sentient hand. When I approached, I realized I was only half right.
The dark, oblong bodies turned out to be upended boats lying on the shore. They looked very old, too. Their blackened sides cracked, rotten, and gaping with holes. What did this imply? The first thing that came to mind was that there must have been a settlement of sentient creatures nearby. They must have dumped their old boats on the shore to rot. The game offered no prompts when I focused on the boats, which meant they were simply part of the scenery. Wait a sec. Now this was getting interesting. A skeleton lay on the sand next to the last boat. Even with its skull smashed beyond recognition, I couldn't mistake a Noctian for any other race under the sun. And the stone axe, which was still lying under the boat, was a sure giveaway. Plus, all the footprints around were old and barely discernible. These weren't Noctians. How very interesting. Let's follow him, kiddo, I told Boris, leaping back into the saddle. We didn't have far to go. I discovered the next skeleton lying about 500 feet further on. This Noctian had large boulders piled up on him. His head was a mess. Apparently, he'd tried to climb out from under the rocks. I could see that by the deep claw marks left on the boulder's surface. Now, why did this look familiar? I think I was right, I whispered, casting watchful glances around. Let's land over there. I pointed at a wide cliff ledge overhanging the rocky trail. The ledge was easy to access and offered plenty of space to lie in hiding for whoever had used it to surprise their unwanted guests. There, the entrance to a cave, just as I'd thought. It was cleverly concealed by some bushes, which, I was pretty sure, hadn't grown there on their own accord. I set Pranky free for a bit of a runaround and let him check the place out. His lithe, predatory shadow disappeared within the dark passage. A few minutes later, he was already back. All clear. I patted his hackles and stepped into the darkness. The rock corridor wasn't that long. Soon I was already through to the other side. I took cover behind a large boulder and blinked the sunlight out of my eyes. The cave hadn't been that dark, especially not for Enon eyesight. But still, the harsh sun rays had momentarily blinded me. I waited for my eyesight to restore and continued on my way. An abandoned settlement, dead and silent, appeared unexpectedly amid the cliffs. At first sight, it looked dramatically different to the farm I'd encountered earlier. This stockade was well built and fortified with rocks piled up to half its height, discouraging any unwanted visitors. Cliffs protected the settlement from both sides. A sturdy gate towered at the center, bristling with sharpened staves. This was a well-conceived and well-kept compound. Skulls of unknown animals topped some of the stakes. Judging by their impressive fangs, they were definitely predators. Two wooden watchtowers flanked the gate. I didn't notice any sentries or archers on them. The little fortified settlement appeared perfectly dead. A few Noctian skeletons lay under the wall, apparently killed by arrows and other missiles. The weapons themselves, however, seemed to be missing. Someone must have collected them after the battle. That was good news. It meant someone might still be alive. I couldn't help admiring the formidable little structure. Everywhere I looked, I saw evidence of a mercilessly bloody battle. The walls and the gate were covered in dark spots, which seemed to have permeated the wood and caked on the rock, telling me that the settlement's defenders met their foe honorably, spilling a lot of enemy blood in the process. A growl came from below. I couldn't confuse that sound with anything. Gingerly, I stepped toward the edge of the cliff ledge. Noctians. Just as I thought. Five of them. They staggered along, dragging their feet with exhaustion and growling at each other. Their front limbs hung listlessly at their sides. All of them seemed to have been wounded. Aha. And there were the defenders coming. A few creatures appeared in the stockade. Two on the walls, and one on each of the watchtowers. They were definitely Kaltean. Having said that, they were sort of small. Puny. Their armor was definitely too big for them. I was an idiot! Those were kids! Young boys! Judging by the Noctians' happy growling, they'd noticed them too. They scurried toward the settlement as fast as they could. The first arrows flew from the walls. Too early. What were they doing on the walls anyway? Where were all the adults? Why had they allowed children to defend the place? Never mind. I'd find that out some other time. Hold on, kids. We're coming. On my command, Boris soared high in the sky, then darted downwards. "Your entry, Steely Guts!" I shouted, releasing a scorpion. "So when did that happen?" I asked.
"A fortnight ago, maybe more. We didn't count the days,"
a teenage Kaltean boy replied. His name was Yunai. No one came here after that? It had been 2 hours since we'd finished off the Noctians, who'd been quite the worse for wear to begin with. I'd been lucky. Their energy had been depleted, their life bars hovering at 20%. The latter must have tipped the scales in our favor, I suppose. The children had met me warily at first. Still, through some inexplicable insight of their own, they'd recognized me as a red owl. From then on, their mistrust had disappeared. Sitting on the wall's broad ramparts, I was now talking to the young defenders.
"No one's been since then."
Yunai shook his head. I looked at them in disbelief. It was incredible how much they'd suffered in these 2 short weeks. The clan of the Sea Tigers had been attacked by a large Noctian tribe who'd slaughtered all the adults in a one-sided battle. Only a few children had survived, 4 boys and 2 girls. Having said that, now that you looked at Yunai and the squat little Torm, you wouldn't call them children anymore. Once all the adults had been killed, they became responsible for the settlement's survival. "Which one of you dropped the boulder onto the Noctian whose bones I found by the boats?" I asked. Torm and Yunai exchanged surprised glances.
"I did throw a rock at him, yes,"
Torm replied. "Did you finish off the other one, too?" He nodded, then added vaguely,
"I used the same rock."
"The same boulder, you mean?"
"Yeah. It was the best I could find. Hard and sharp. I spent some time picking the right one.
I chuckled. I see. A rock. The kid was strong, that's for sure. That's probably what Krim or Ormin used to be like when they were young. Torm was a real giant for his age. He had large hands, broad shoulders, and big feet. He was almost the same height as myself. But that wasn't what worried me. It was the weird look in his eyes. Hard and cruel. Then again, what did I know? The kid had just lost his entire family, killed before his very eyes. What kind of look was he supposed to have? So, all in all, the young sea tigers had left a most favorable impression on me. Especially Yunai, the eldest, who now was their leader. I couldn't help comparing myself to the boy. Would I have been able to preserve my own courage and integrity in his place? He too had had his entire family killed before his eyes by hungry Noctian cannibals. He had no one but a handful of scared boys like himself to turn to. Still, it hadn't prevented him from getting his act together and saving the few survivors.
"How did you know?"
Torm asked. "How did I know what?"
"That we threw a rock at him,"
Yunai explained, curious. I followed Torm's footprints.
"His footprints?"
"Yes. Actually, I only saw three of them. Two were by the old boat, and one more in the passage between the rocks. At first, I thought they belonged to a small man, because I couldn't imagine such a big boy could exist." I nodded at Torm, who puffed his chest out with pride. Yunai gave me an understanding smile.
"It's been days. How did you see them?"
Torm demanded. "Just by being observant, that's all. Your footprints were the deepest because you carried something heavy. The boulder, apparently. Did you know that that was the only way you could break a Noctian skull? Throwing something heavy from a great height? You don't have to be very observant to notice the cliffs overhanging the shore exactly where it happened."
"But surely the rain and wind would have destroyed our prints after so many days,"
Yunai pointed out. "Absolutely. That's exactly what happened. Which is why I only found three footprints. Two of them had survived because they were left next to the upended boat, which protected them from the wind. The third one on the rocky trail was even easier. Torm must have stepped accidentally into the Noctian's blood and left a footprint on the pebbles next to the body. That's basically it." They fell silent. Yunai sat mouthing something, as if trying to memorize what I'd just said. Torm was contemplating his own feet, as if he was seeing them for the first time.
"Where did you come from?"
Yunai asked, changing the subject. "From the Forbidden City," I said. Their eyes opened wide. "I'm the keeper of the Forbidden City," I explained. "In actual fact, I've offered refuge to the surviving Chaldean clans, whatever's left of them."
"Surviving clans?"
Yunai asked in disbelief. "Of course," I replied. "Silver Mountain Valley was invaded by a Noctian horde. Didn't you know?" They exchanged glances, then shook their heads in unison. "Oh, I didn't expect that."
"But what are the clans doing in the Forbidden City?"
Yunai asked.
"It's in the north, isn't it?"
"Lots of reasons. The shamans couldn't come to an agreement, so the clans split to go each their own way." As I spoke, they kept exchanging bewildered stares.
If Laosh could only see the boy's reaction to the clever decisions of his supposedly wise colleagues. So I had to tell them everything from the start. About the Chaldeans.